When teenagers kill themselves at a stage in their lives that should be so filled with hope and possibility, we struggle to understand. Survivors torment themselves, asking what they could have done. Paul Gianfrido, president and CEO of Mental Health America, has some answers to their questions. He's in town for a talk on Thursday called Youth Suicide Prevention. Let's talk about 13 reasons why. We spoke earlier this morning, and he said suicidal teenagers have often been showing signs for years of what was to come.
It doesn't really come out of the blue. For a lot of times when people have had a tragic event like this and you start talking to people, what you discover is that they did notice that there was something different about this particular person when they were a child. And often the child is also seeking help. The teachers have noticed there's something different. The clinicians who are involved have noticed there's something different. It's just that we didn't act on that because we were uncertain what to do.
What would acting on that consist of?
I think providing support for kids way before there are any kinds of behavioral manifestations is what's most needed. And by that I mean it's moving them toward further engagement, for lack of a better word, with other kids and with adults, as opposed to isolation. Because if you look at this, oftentimes what people see is somebody moving toward isolation, kid who wants to be off by himself or herself, staying in the bedroom or not wanting to go out or not feeling like they have friends, or even though they seem like friendly people and everybody likes them, it's those isolating events, those getting caught up in their own heads and their own thoughts that you want to kind of pull them away from and say, let's look at engaging with other peers and engaging with parents.
We live in a society, and especially an adolescent society, that encourages having a lot of friends and making sure the world knows how many friends, you know, literally counting their numbers via social media and things like that. For the kid who is already feeling a little bit marginalized, does that further marginalize him or her?
Yeah, it can. And really, those are frequently surface friendships, right? Those are not true friendships. Somebody's once said, you know, big mistake you can make in government or elsewhere is thinking that all of your Facebook friends are your personal friends.
Yeah.
And that's true with kids too. So sometimes the numbers, yeah, I've got 900 friends and I've got 1,500 and you've only got 100.
Yeah.
But what we really need is a closer sense of engagement with the people who are our friends. Nobody really needs more than a couple of close friends, really. Mm-hmm. But it makes it harder if it becomes a competition about numbers and quantity as opposed to quality.
The act of forging a close friendship involves some skills, you know, social skills, understanding, empathy, understanding fairly sophisticated interaction with other people, which seems to have been lost in some of today's society.
Yeah, you don't get that level of sophisticated interaction as much when you're just dealing with posting things on your wall, for example, mm-hmm. or tweeting things out. And, mm-hmm. you know, we've certainly seen examples of that even among adults where it's very hard to engage and around that kind of discourse. And so for kids, it really becomes critically important to try to look for more traditional forms of engagement. You know, can you get people in activities? Can you get people in group efforts within school? Can you just have kids talking to other kids in the cafeteria and stuff like that? Those become so much more important than what they're doing on social media.
The whole idea of teenage suicide, of somebody at an age when life is just starting to explode with possibility, just runs counter to our belief in life being worthwhile, doesn't it? It's something fundamentally that disturbs us about it beyond the immediate terrible pain of it.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest problems that we have as adults is we're really afraid of that.
Exactly.
You know, we're just afraid of what that, and yet the kids need to talk about this. And, you know, I found that last year with the show 13 Reasons Why, where so many adults and so many adult professionals were saying this is a bad thing, this is going to glamorize suicide, this is doing all kinds of other things. But what they were putting is so much of their own emotion into this about how they felt about the deaths of people they knew, their parents, their loved ones, their
others. This
was the
TV show that traced a teenage suicide to
its
various sources.
That's right. And it really, you know, exposed a chain of events that led up to mm-hmm. this particular event. And it was, I think, so important for young people to understand, to be able to watch it and understand that, you know, at stage 1 of 13 or at stage 4 of 13, you might be able to intervene. That was your opportunity to come in and make a difference in the life of this mm-hmm. individual. But from the perspective of parents, they were so afraid of their kids seeing it because they thought their kids would jump from stage 1 to stage 13 or show 1 to show 13. And so they fear talking about it. And I think a lot of times adults fear talking about something as serious as suicide with kids, yet there's no evidence that talking about suicide gives anybody an idea that they should start thinking about suicide.
Well, depression is probably the most common pathway. And a lot of times when someone is depressed, he or she gets, you know, snap out of it. You have so many reasons to be happy. It becomes a kind of a criticism. Does that help?
Of course not. Doesn't help at all. And, you know, we have an online screening program at Mental Health America. People all over the country, about 3,000 a day come and take a screen. We've had more than 3 million people take screens. The largest cohort is 11 to 17-year-olds. And the most common screen that people take is the depression screen. And I often tell people that there are 9 questions in the depression screen. It's the PHQ-9. It's the clinical screen that's used mm-hmm. most frequently. And the 8th most frequently positively answered question, so number 8 out of 9, is the suicidal ideation question. What it says is there are people with severe depression who are walking around, they've never had a suicidal thought in their lives. So it doesn't help to tell people who may have severe depression, oh, fix it yourself, pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, just feel better, smile more, because they have a serious health condition yeah. that we need to be able to address, and we need to be able to address it in multiple ways.
As I understand clinical depression, correct me if I'm wrong, it is not, you can't necessarily talk your way out of it. It's like a virus at its worst, right?
Oh, I think that's a good way for people to think about it. I often talk to my own daughter who's got some mental health issues, and I say, you know, for you, you know, you have a kind of a relapse a couple times a year, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 times a year. I said, that's like your cold. A lot of people have a cold and they have to take a week off. You know, you get this, and you have to think about it the same way. You call your doctor, you get your meds changed or a new med introduced if you need to, and if you have to go to bed for a couple days, you go to bed for a couple days. And it's a helpful way to think about it, and it is the way we should be thinking about it.
In a way, what you're saying is don't be afraid of it.
Yeah.
You're not afraid of the flu. You just take your meds and go to bed, right?
Yeah. And if we were not afraid, if we did the same thing, told people not to be afraid, or told people, you know, you can overcome this yourself, well, we know we can't. You know, he's like, yes, you can sleep, you know, for flu and all that, but you do need to take your meds also, or you know. And I think that's the part. Not being afraid of it and simply treating it as any other condition or health condition, that's the part we miss on this, because we think about them as behavioral. And we think about, oh, you can change your behaviors. Well, not really.
A suicidal teenager might well have heard a lot of things that he or she took as criticism, things that didn't help. Things that were said with love. I mean, these aren't meant as attacks, are they? These are said by loving friends and parents. It just don't work. Is that fair to say?
Well, it is, because if what it boils down to is advice about what people should do, then it's really hard for people to interpret that as something other than criticism. But if you provide people options and choices and say, these are all useful options, useful choices that could be helpful to you, pick the one that makes most sense to you, that gets you in the door, now you're in the door to meaningful treatment. And for a lot of people, those options might be a talk therapy or behavioral in that sense. For others, it may be meds. For others, it may be engaging with a peer, somebody who's been through it themselves, another teenager or an adult. But just for people to know, I choose. It's up to me to choose that one, and nobody's going to tell me I had to do this on my own. That can make a big difference to people.
Paul Gianfrido is the president and CEO of Mental Health America and the author of Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. Paul will be the featured speaker at Mental Health America of Hawaii's Youth Suicide Prevention Let's Talk About 13 Reasons Why. That's Thursday at 5:30 p.m. in the Manoa Grand Ballroom. The event is free and open to the public.